As someone who grew up in a massive city, and yes, I know I probably spend more time than I should talking about it, city life always seemed expected to me. It was the blueprint, in a way, for life as I understood it. I have mentioned before the value I found moving to a small rural town, and people often remark how that change must have been incredibly difficult or even just a culture shock in its own right. In my episode on suburbia, I introduced the idea of RUCA codes, which are a way to standardize the closest of a location from an urban center. The closer you are, the closer your town is to a 1, and the further you are, the closer your town is to a 10. I grew up in Los Angeles, which is a 1. My family now lives outside of LaFarge, which is a 10. I've gone from one end of the extreme spectrum to another. Now, 4 for 10 for RUCA codes are considered to be rural, and where I go to university, it is still a 1 despite being in the middle of nowhere, so it's not that extreme. But it's a lot for a definitive city kid, at least. And one of the many things I've learned and picked up on through living 2 years and visiting over breaks in rural America is that cities are fascinating. In particular, I've become more curious about city planning and the grid lines that serve as evidence for both their intentionality and their accidental nature. Hello, and welcome to Jackie On, a podcast where I, Jackie, talk about my opinions on a bunch of different topics. This episode is Jackie on the intricacies of city planning. To be completely honest, there are courses and degrees dedicated to this very topic, and the more research I've done, the more overwhelmed I am with all the positions I could talk about. But seeing as this is Jackie on and not Jackie Informs, I will try to stick to things that are most interesting to me or that I have observed on a more personal note. But first, I wanted to frame this topic with some insights I learned from reading A Burglar's Guide to the City by Jeff Minot, and that is a lot of the way cities are planned is on course with random invention and innovation. The first towns and cities in the United States weren't expected to host skyscrapers and underground tunnel systems until the elevator, for instance, was invented in 1853, or until the underground rail system was devised, and now a city like New York City cannot be conceived without considering the subway. As a result, when the system and the city gets more complicated, control and force must enter the equation. So now a lot of the cities we see are controlled by local government zoning laws that decide what can and can't be built, and unless a city planner gets a seat at that table, it's up in the air about what restrictions will be placed on a town or a city for development, and that can be a good or bad depending on the changes and the location. But still, I'm trying to make it clear with this framing that cities didn't just sprout out of the ground, but their existence has been a long process culminating with various people all trying to get a slice of the pie. Some of the control of the system with either a new invention or a law, but for the most part, if you want to talk about the origin of cities and where they came from, that's one thing, but I think it's really important to consider how they reflect into the modern age, and that is a lot of the times, even you could plan things out, and I'll talk a little bit more about the actual planning process later, but at the end of the day, you're all subject to whatever new inventions come out and new ways of building that arise that you might not have had 10, 20 years prior. But let's to speak a little bit now about some of the fundamentals here. From an article I read, it claimed that most urban design professionals would say a good city plan, quote, conserves the natural environment and is responsive to it, creates a desirable public realm that includes transportation, streets, civic spaces, shopping, entertainment, parks, and recreation, and supports social interaction, end quote. And while there can be a balance to this operation, there are people who seek to develop and enhance one of these categories over another. These people often have some form of connection, some backing, or intention. There are public, private, and citizen-backed motives for every modern design choice in a city, and when profit wins out over fitting to the environment, you have situations like the Los Angeles wildfires overtaking homes because controlled burning was no longer allowed near rich people's homes that were built in the middle of the woods. Or you have flooding becoming more common in Houston and coastal cities. So I think this is also something really interesting that speaks to the natural part of where cities are first conceived to be built and where they're first thought of. And I find this perspective endlessly fascinating because it basically implies that while yes, cities are designed for breathability, for people to get around, they also must be designed based on the environmental and biological conditions demanded by the foundations. So this, of course, leads us to talk about how most cities are built around fertile lands, a water source, or some kind of natural environmental advantage. City planning in the modern era, by which I mean after the development of the car, has become about anticipating growth and trying to emulate patterns from cities that were successful. So while maybe one was built around a water source and so was another, they kind of try to mimic the other one that seemed to be successful or grew in a way that was inviting a lot of people to come there, or so on and so forth. So it's really interesting if you kind of trace these patterns of growth because there's usually some example city that was used to pin up another one. But not every city can be reduced to the same exact framework. In fact, a study actually came out to define what they call intensity of plannedness as a new criteria to evaluate how planned out cities are. There are five stages to this. One, extremely spontaneous, predominantly spontaneous, evenly spontaneous and planned, predominantly planned, and extremely planned. One of the main factors used to determine if something was spontaneous or planned is how much change the city had undergone since the founding urban process and how many entities were responsible for the initial planning. So let's say there was a handful of people who were responsible for the planning and the city's undergone so much growth and development, that would indicate that it was pretty spontaneous because there wasn't necessarily a long-term plan in place. Whereas if one or two entities or organizations helped create a city and then it hasn't changed that much, like sure, it's grown and expanded with technology, but it hasn't necessarily changed from an initial planning point, then that would be a really planned city. So a lot of it comes down to the ability for the planners initially to have that vision of the future in mind when they were planning things. They essentially, in the study though, what was interesting is they took snapshots of different grid lines and planning, and with some special calculations, we're able to find each one of them in these categories. They looked at like 381 sites to see, okay, what snapshot is an example of planned, not planned, spontaneous, and things like that. And I thought it was a pretty legit study. And just to give some examples, downtown Los Angeles is completely planned. Chicago Loop and Manhattan East Village are predominantly planned, but Sao Paulo Centro and Dublin Temple Bar are predominantly spontaneous. And Islamabad Al-Maher Colony in Pakistan is completely spontaneous. And so if you look at some of these images, right, you have very, very organized grid lines, which typically fall into more completely planned sectors. And then there's kind of like these random intersections of lines that indicate different streets. And those are more in the spontaneous end because they needed to add streets to where people were living or where they were doing work, and that ended up not necessarily falling in an exact row, whereas in a lot of the predominantly planned places or completely planned places, these lines are already set up and people like lived around them. And I think that's one of the interesting parts about it is, okay, do we have people living here first and can we correct them to fit into this nicely organized shape, or are we just going to have to connect the people and deal with what we got? And I think that also really comes down to how something is planned along with the lines that are used in order to showcase this. I think this is so interesting to me because it speaks to a kind of fundamentality about city planning, and that is it's not the same everywhere. And I think that might be kind of obvious, but it bears repeating. In fact, there is very little that has ever remained the same with planning other than, you know, something that's even something completely planned. As I mentioned earlier, when reading Bergler's Guide to the City, it talks about different technological innovations and different changes that occur in a city. And of course, that book is about how burglars don't see architectural challenges or structures as walls, but rather as a way to get around them or a way to subvert them. And that's how they navigate the city, which is quite interesting. But I do think, for the most part, that there hasn't been a lot that's remained the same in terms of exact staticness, right? Rome looks different than New York, and that's all it might seem obvious, but some of the same planning techniques were used and some of the same truths between those two cities can still remain true. And that is kind of going into what I'm going to talk about here, which is kind of one exception to things that will always stay the same. And so while the nature of a city and planning has changed a lot, it kind of hasn't in some ways. And one thing that has shaped cities since the beginning, from even earlier civilizations in Greece, is Marchetti's constant. Basically, it looks at the average time spent commuting for a person on a one-way trip is 30 minutes, or 1 hour for both ways. And that's like a truism of everything. So let's say I have to go commute somewhere, right? It will be 30 minutes average. Now, of course, there will be changes depending on a specific person. Maybe there's a light traffic day, a heavy traffic day, but on average, it will be exactly 30 minutes. And even as distances have increased and the mode of travel has changed, this average is constant. If it was 2 miles on foot and is now 20 miles via a car, the timing will stay the same. It will take me 30 minutes regardless, on average. And I think this is really interesting because it shows that while we have changed a lot and the cities we have look different and maybe some of, you know, our planning ideas have stayed the same or whatnot, at the end of the day, our mode of transport, our way of moving in the world remains pretty similar to how it used to be. Even as we're planning cities out more and more, the ways in which we get around these cities, the transportation, and the ways in which we live in the city hasn't changed all that much. I think that speaks to not only the need for humans, you know, to complicate things, but also our need and our ability to keep things the same. And going into some more detail about transportation, it can be in an entirely separate episode because that is full of detail and so conditional. It surrounds topics of eminent domain, and we can even talk about high-speed rail, which those two are interconnected. And so transportation is huge in the United States. But to talk about LA again for a moment, it's actually quite interesting because the way the East Coast was planned was definitely for carriage and horse. These cities were starting to be built for an entirely different purpose than we have now. Of course, they don't look the same, but these small and narrow remnant cobblestone streets can still be seen. But if you look at the West Coast, it was built predominantly for the early modern car. While this sounds like it would lead to better built cities, that's not necessarily true. Many freeways, including the Arroyo Seco Parkway built in 1940, were created for cars that drove at much slower speeds and were quite narrow. So while a car going 30 miles an hour could do fine with a sharp and sudden off-ramp, a car going 75 miles an hour needs to speed down much sooner or be taken off guard and get into an accident. And I think in terms of city planning, this speaks a lot to some of the things that you don't necessarily have control over, right? When you're planning a city, you might not know that a car is coming. You might know that cars are going to exist at some point, but you also might not. And so you can't factor that in as a possibility when you're trying to create a road and make sure it's wide enough. And we see that even now where a lot of the freeways in LA were built for slower cars. And so now, inevitably, we're going to have faster cars and new traffic laws, but the freeways were not built to accommodate that. And so you almost have these accidental moments of city planning where the future is not considered, or it's very hard to consider the future. And instead we get these weird static remnants of the past that do affect us now and make it so that, you know, for example, the freeways are less safe in Los Angeles. To add on to this is something interesting that I came across, and that is that novelist Charles Bukowski wrote in a poem titled Drive Through Hell, quote, "When I drive the freeways, I see the soul of humanity of my city, and it's ugly, ugly, ugly. The living have choked the heart away," end quote. And yes, this poem has been angsty, and Bukowski has an interesting reputation, but it still rings true to many. The conversation about car culture and the American freeway system, in particular capitalized on in Los Angeles, and the ugliness of it, deserves its own entire episode. However, at the forefront of city planning is transportation and how people can get around. So it's worth bringing up some of these key inflection points, so to speak, just so they can remain relevant in this conversation. And I really think that does show, part of my purpose in bringing that poem was to show that, yes, this does affect people, that even if we talk about city planning like some abstract mastermind plan, you know, making a city in The Sims or something, at the end of the day, when we're talking about real cities, they do affect real people. And I think that's something that is important to consider because it's very easy just to think about, okay, a city, as opposed to, oh yeah, what happens in a city? Who's in a city? Who does their business in a city? Who's coming into the city, leaving the city? Like, there's so many factors of people that are a lot harder to manage than the simple organization of landscape. So while I have give kind of some examples of more deliberate planning in a city, I also want to show some instances that are a lot less deliberate. And I don't mean like, oh, we couldn't have planned for the future, but as in, oh, this happened and now it's a reality and we didn't realize or intend it to be a reality. So I once did a program for Jewish students. It was kind of a trip to meet up with Jewish leaders around the U.S. But I remember there was someone there from New Orleans. And when we were in the car to the airport, since we had a similar flight times, he was talking all about how interesting the grid lines were and how something called the white teapot, a term jokingly coined by geographer Richard Campanella, and what it did to the city during Hurricane Katrina and what it kind of represented. It's basically this region in New Orleans that curves due to being next to the Mississippi River, from where the pot of the teapot is at the Carrollton Uptown along St. Charles Avenue to the French Quarter where the spout extends. Anyway, the point of this and the reason why it's called the White Teapot is because this area is of higher elevation than all the surrounding areas. And it was developed pretty early on and is a white majority high income area. And if you look at it on a map, it's really interesting because this one teapot, as the geographer named it, is basically just the swatch of predominantly white individuals living in that area, surrounded by predominantly black and Latino individuals living in the surrounding area at lower elevation. And so when Hurricane Katrina hit, this meant that there were areas more disproportionately affected and harmed than the white teapot, for instance, because of the high ground. And while one could argue that this is deliberate because the population living there understands the benefits being on higher ground when surrounded by the risk of floods and the swamp that is New Orleans, for the most part, no one set out for it to happen. No one sat down and said, hey, okay, this is a higher area. We should have these people living here. Instead, it just happened over time, a congregation of people in a specific place that made the prices go up in that area and made it so only certain people could afford living there. And now it's become a facet of the city plan. Right, that there is this one area and it has helped define the grid lines themselves, tell the story, and so does the population data, which is very fascinating. So the city wasn't planned to have this specific teapot with only one general race living there. The point here I'm trying to make is that environmental conditions and populations have a heavy hand in shaping how a city grows and what it becomes, maybe even more than the city planners themselves. At the end of the day, city planners essentially set out a plan and try to make it happen. But people's reactions to it and people's ways of being and living and existing in community and neighborhoods kind of all model and shape the way that the city's initially planned. And so I think while this has been a massive collection of just random different thoughts about city planning, different things that go into it, I really do think it's important to have conversations about how a city's planned and what goes into it and the people who are affected by it as they... cities, I mean, will be sprawling as populations grow. And so too will the need for us to rethink how our cities are built and who they are supposed to be serving. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Jackie On. I'll catch you in the next one.